All right, recording. Hello and welcome. We are the Brothers Geek, and this is our podcast. My name is Patrick Schmaltz with my two brothers, Christopher Schmaltz. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, good evening.
And my other brother, Andrew. Hello, Andrew.
Hello and good evening.
We're brothers, we're geeks. We talk about geeky things. This is episode number 167, recording this November 8th. So I haven't done this in a while, but guess what? It's a Dune one shot. If you haven't seen Dune, we're going to talk about Dune. It's been out for a couple weeks. We gave you a couple weeks to, because we're probably going to go spoiler heavy here. This is your only warning, Dune one shot. So if you haven't seen Dune, go watch Dune and come back. What are you doing with your life? So a little bit of backstory. I feel like we've talked about Dune since day one. I feel like when we were doing like Scene Red Played, we were, if anybody remembers us doing that, I think the first book we read together was Dune. And I remember
I never read the book before we started recording the podcast.
That's what I'm saying.
I read the book because we were going to read it and talk about it on the podcast.
Well, and Chris, when did you read Dune for the first time? Like, what was your, tell us about your origin of why you bought Dune and when you were like old and they were still, you know, riding in trains and
steam powered. Did you have a horse and buggy that took
horse and buggy to go buy the book, dude?
We cannot transfer those old jokes from dad to me.
I sure can, dude.
I was 13 when I read it first. 13.
Nice. Yeah.
1983. Did you read it in anticipation of the movie coming out in 1984, the David Lynch movie? Okay.
Hell no.
Yeah, when did you see... Okay, we'll come back to that, but like I'm curious about like when you saw the David Lynch Dune. Did you see it in the theater?
I have no memory of seeing it in the theater.
Okay.
Have you repressed that memory?
I might be repressing that
memory. I mean...
I have distinct... I definitely had read the book... Maybe it was earlier than 13, because I definitely read the book at least a couple times. Like, I was already down the path of this is the greatest science fiction novel and maybe one of the greatest novels of all time.
Do you remember, like, hearing about it, or you had a friend recommend it, or, like, what was the... I'm really curious about, like, what drew you to... Like the OG Dune, you know?
Yeah, you know, dad was a science fiction reader as an adult. And we had science fiction books at home. And me being me, I did the exploratory, what are the science fiction books I need to read?
Mm.
You were like that as a young teenager, too?
Yeah, you were like, a giant nerd at 13? Jeez.
Yeah.
you just popped out of the pod. Like, yeah. Totally.
This time in my life, I was at the... we were in Crookston. And I was at the public library a lot.
I see. Okay. Cool.
And I was a fixture in the science fiction aisle. I don't think dad had a copy.
There are a few things in life as good or as somehow satisfying tactily as a public library hardcover with like the plastic wrapping on it, you know, the sound of it when you open it and kind of I love checking out. I don't do it ever.
There's no question.
A library book is awesome.
We have a library near our house here that I've gone in a couple of times, and it's kind of like this weird thing of like, yeah, they only have so many books and it's kind of small. And I want to go to like a huge library, like what you imagine that has like every book you'd ever think of. Yeah. But, and I'm sure they exist in the LA, but
I'm sure they... like the main branch of the LA Public Library has got to be enormous.
Yeah, I hope so. Like that's what I want. Yeah.
I was in small town Minnesota, and the library was, man, it was a mainstay for me. I played the original Oregon Trail on a computer at that
time. Nice.
Oh yes.
Oh gee.
I
you have died of dysentery.
There's no question. There's no question that that's sort of what where I started looking at it, and I am certain. Soon after reading it for the first time, I bought a paperback of it, and I had a paperback, and I had easily read it a couple times before that movie came out.
Okay,
and I don't remember exactly when I saw. We might have gone to it in the theater. We might have, but I know. I don't know exactly when I saw it the first time. It was certainly when I was a teenager.
Well,
and I knew enough already, and I was immersed enough already to be completely appalled and
horrified. I think that, like, the first time I watched it was, like, we had HBO growing up, and I think our parents, it was just on HBO one day, like, one afternoon, and I was like, Dune? And I'd, like, heard of it maybe, but then, it like... The music was really cool. Like, Toto's music was, like, really cool. And I was young. I was hella young. And I remember thinking it was kind of crappy, but I didn't know any different because I hadn't read the book. And kind of weird, especially, like, the whispering in their head things was, like, super aggravating. And then
yeah,
later...
The internal monologue
is the worst part. That's the most cringeworthy, worst part of that. Yeah.
It's just
so terrible. Like, whoever made that... I mean, David Lynch making that, like, a creative choice of need internal monologue. We need to hear them thinking. And this is how we're going to portray that. It's just...
Here's what I'll say. Here's what I'll say in defense of David Lynch for a minute. I think... Later years, when we finally read this book for this podcast, I thought to myself, this book is impossible to make into a movie. It's impossible to make it into a movie that is entertaining. And I understand why the David Lynch version turned out the way it did, because a movie structure is so different. There's action set pieces, there's character arc, there's, like, different kind of, like, entertaining things to keep you going. There's so much to explain. And the great part of Dune is the setting and all that goes on and, like, the crazy stuff that leads up, the really subtle nature that goes into, like, what happens to Paul that is so hard to explain in a film.
Well, that's what we... I mean, we've talked about that. We've admittedly told that to other people, that the novel is 600 pages long, and the first 100 pages are so dense and so kind of not impenetrable, but it is a steep climb to get through that first 100 pages and kind of, like, understand the world that you're in because it hits you. It just drops you into the deep end of the pool, and it's like, sink or swim, this is the world, these are the players. You have to, like, really commit to this book.
And there's a lot of, like...
It's not light reading. It's not light reading, which is the beauty of the book, because it's not something that's brain candy, but it's also, when it's not brain candy, you really have to commit, and it's a steep, steep climb
to read this
book.
And also, there's so much introspection that is, like, the plot is not moving forward. It's just Paul... thinking about stuff and understanding the world and figuring out
Jessica,
his place.
Or it's
right.
Jessica.
Or it's Jessica.
Thinking about things for 10 pages.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Considering
all the political...
Yes.
Okay, we got to move past because we're literally...
So, okay, that's the setup.
3 hours.
That's the setup. That's the setup, but we all went and saw...
Here's the question I want to pose.
Yeah.
And we have to start from a jumping point of... We've all seen it twice.
I've seen it three times now.
Okay, we've all seen it at least.
I watched it at home the third time.
It gets better the second time. Am I right?
Oh, sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So as dense and as... This is a movie that has rewatchability.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yeah.
Absolutely. We're going to fanboy this out before we deconstruct it all. Chris, what was your favorite part of the movie?
Oh my gosh.
Give us your favorite. What do you, like, jump to as something that you just loved that keeps coming back at you that you loved?
The Gom Jabbar test.
Okay.
That scene was everything I wanted it to be, and everything that, I mean, it was a, in my mind, a perfect realization of the scene in the book.
Yeah.
And it captures it again, hugely difficult scene to film because everything going on in that scene in the book is all inside there.
Yeah, there's exactly. Nothing happening.
There's so little dialogue. Right. There's actually so little dialogue.
His hand is inside a box, and it's just happening to him. Yeah.
It's an incredible scene in the book, and hugely difficult to film. And I was just, I had goosebumps in that scene because I thought Villeneuve understood it, and realized that she was hoping that she would get to kill him.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And pushing it past the limit of anything she had ever, the extreme test. They hint at it in the movie, but in the book, it's like I've never tested someone so hard before. Well, man or woman. And the defiance, the Chalamet defiance as Paul, that look on his face and looking at her when he sort of got it. Mm-hmm. And then also the juxtaposition of Jessica knowing that her son could be dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this test is like you're dead or you pass. Those are your options.
And Denis makes significant changes to this scene in two ways in my mind. He brings Jessica into the scene because you get Rebecca Ferguson standing in the hall struggling with the fact that her beloved son that she has been the person closest to him in his life. Duncan plays a role in his life. Obviously, Gurney Halleck, obviously his father, but
he's been training him.
She has been training him his entire life. He spends every day with her.
Yeah.
This is the person they are close to most in the world.
Jessica's struggle
standing in that hallway and then her reciting the Bene Gesserit litany against fear rather than Paul.
She's thinking of the Duke too. So
exactly.
She Paul is her supreme act of love for the Duke. So all of those emotions, just a genius idea to bring her into that scene because she's tormented on multiple levels. Betrayal of the sisterhood.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic the other scene. Question, that's my number
there,
one
there,
scene
there,
in the movie.
There's a question.
I have one more.
Well, hold on. Before we go anywhere. Yeah. I have questions about that scene that, I don't remember if the book explains this better, but the sisters told her to make a daughter so that she could get, so the daughter of the Duke would marry off a Harkonnen and end the problems between those guys. That's sort of what the book alludes to, I believe. And they never really talk about that in the movie.
Also allude to that.
The Princess Haderach
is going to issue from.
So that's another question, right?
From that union,
the next generation, right? We'll create the next generation,
that you learn all of that stuff in the next couple books.
Okay, yeah. Well, I feel like they talk about that a little bit in the first book because, like, I knew that, I have that in my head.
That interaction at the end when she says, "Hey, you were supposed to have a daughter." Because we had a plan, and this is a 1,000-year-old plan, and you've fucked it up.
They really start to make you understand what the Bene Gesserit sisterhood is like, really doing, and like they have power, but they're also capable of making a boy or a girl, like in their body. Like they just can control their body so much that she could decide,
All about self-mastery. I mean,
self-mastery, exactly.
The building the discipline and the self-mastery of the human animal.
To the cellular level.
I love the line, so much wasted potential on a male. Right. And it's sort of just like, it really starts to hit home that like, they have, they're like the peak woman in this universe, where they are, you know, they're like controlling this, the what's happening with the houses and behind closed doors, and being like, also marrying off people.
They're the main power players.
Main power players behind the scenes are this group of powerful women.
The great houses kind of like think that they're in control, but they are moving all the chess pieces.
Absolutely
moving the chess pieces.
Also, something to your point, Christopher, that's the best part of this scene is the visual representation of what the voice is in this world. And if did you guys watch that video of Denis Villeneuve?
I watched the whole fucking thing.
So fantastic. Like him and I didn't even realize it, but like he like she says to come over here, and then he's just over there. Like you have no control once it's
black
used
out.
Black out and you just do the thing that someone told you to do.
Yeah.
And he like
your will is overpowered.
That 2 seconds of filmmaking is so it gives me chills and is amazing. And it's like the power is so interesting in the book, but how do you make that visual? How do you make that and so that's the power of Denis Villeneuve that is like dude, you did it, bro.
And the contrast with David Lynch, who was such a fucking blunt instrument bullshit.
Blunt instrument. He wanted to make Star Wars and make an action movie. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Villeneuve got that exactly right.
Andrew, do you have a favorite scene? That's just.
I mean, I do have. I mean, the whole thing is incredible. I mean, the Gom Jabbar scene, the scenes that stand up from the book, and I really like some of the stuff that actually gets added, or stuff that I don't remember directly from the book, like high points in the book. Like, I enjoy the little scenes with Paul and Duncan, like in the hangar, where Paul's telling about his dreams. I mean, you get the sense from, I mean, it's established in the book that Duncan Idaho is a close like friend slash mentor, but I mean, just from Momoa's magnetic charisma, he's a weapons master. But Duncan is like Paul's older brother. That is exactly where he is in Paul's life, and that is the energy that Momoa brings to it.
But like a complete,
it's perfect. Those little moments between Paul and Duncan, they really humanize what is a very fantastic tale. Mm-hmm. I mean.
Close-knit house. They love each other. Villeneuve understands the book. And that's exactly why all of those... You're exactly right, Andrew. All those ads reinforce all of the ideas from those scenes in the book that are communicate all of those messages, right? This is a family. They are loyal and love one another, and they all support one another, and they are 100% committed to each other. Villeneuve understood all of that. And so that ad reinforced and build on all of the other stuff. And just that scene communicates 50 pages of the book.
I will say this, that my favorite thing that I want like a model of the Ornithopter.
Think it is
such a beautiful, perfectly realized piece of like future tech.
We'll be buying one of those if they become available.
I've been looking on Amazon for like a diecast like metal, you know, 10x12.
It'll exist.
It is such a cool looking piece of future tech, and it's the fact that it's got like an Apache helicopter feel to it at a little bit, the militarized version. And then the part at the end when Paul and Jessica are escaping, it's got like the streamlined, like yacht, older, like yacht or sailing, you know, version of it. I love it. But you when you really kind of break it down and think about it, I know ornithopters probably exist on other planets too, but you wouldn't want an airframe that uses rotating blades in a world completely covered in sand. That would just make no sense. So you build a machine that flaps wings, and it just And you, is a jet that flaps wings, because you need that billet, you need that technology, and using rotating blades in a world that's all sand makes no sense.
Well, and I would like to say too, is like there's a subtle like look at how old school the interior of the jet looks, because it's like the subtle nod that the technology is like only goes so far. There's no computers in this. There's no computers. There's and like even that Gom Jabbar scene, there's books on the wall. You know, there's a library. They don't have big computers. They use people as computers.
Yeah, there's nothing. And nothing's networked. Like our futurescape of the internet and the ubiquity of all knowledge being available at all times.
Yeah,
that's not this world.
Right,
they've advanced to. There's been stuff that's happened where there's been a regression.
But they don't even say any of that in this movie whatsoever. None of that is said.
The point on the Ornithopter is important because it's supportive of the ecological through line of this book of the book, and also what's in the movie is that the humans have realized that you can't really improve upon nature's engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the messaging, certainly of the book, and they touch on it, and I think we're going to get a lot more of it in part two, is the ecology throughput of the book. All of those philosophical ideas and science ecologically. And so I appreciate the ship designs and the Ornithopter design only because it's reflective of the idea that humans have figured out that in this environment, the right engineering is to copy the bugs that thrive and survive in the environment. And so here's what we do and how we design the ship.
And it's another little subtle touch that I was loving, just because the world, the book is so dense, and Denis completes the world in such a way, the little touches of the Muad'Dib showing up at critical moments, and how that kind of becomes Paul.
Incredible.
It becomes Paul's like spirit animal, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's what it is. It's a representation of his soul in a way, and how it shows up in these moments of transformation. I mean, it's a little on the nose. I mean, Denis is subtle in a lot of ways, and he's a beautiful filmmaker, but the moment when Paul and Jessica crawl out from under the sand and the Muad'Dib.
That's straight from the book, dude. He sees the mouse hopping on the desert sand.
It's this image of rebirth and emergence from, you know, a grave. It's just, and he sees the Muad'Dib, like the new life coming to him. It's incredible.
What is the Muad'Dib? What is that?
That's the Fremen word for the desert mouse.
Tiny mouse. Yeah, with the ears.
Oh, I didn't. I know they end up calling him Paul Muad'Dib.
That's the name he chooses.
He says that's in part two. They're gonna say, "What do you want your name to be?" And he will. What's the name of that tiny mouse with the big ears that hops around in the desert? And they all laugh. They all laugh and say that's Muad'Dib. And he is foreshadowing that shit.
Yeah.
Denis understands that.
Well,
that
is
of all of that.
And like, here's something that I say that like modern scripts don't really do very well, and I appreciate it when it's done well. It's called setup and payoff, guys. You set up something that you mm-hmm. don't understand. The audience has no idea what it means. But then it comes back to explain it, and you see him watching the video with the mouse in it, running in the grass, sees it in the desert, and then that leads to part two, which you're talking about, and it's like that's brilliant. You're thinking you know the whole story, so you can insert, and that's like good filmmaking. It's just good filmmaking.
Well, it really is good.
It appeals to us because. When filmmakers do that, they respect their audience. When when they overly communicate things, they're not trusting their audience to really dig and want to understand and be engaged with the story. But Denis respects us, and he wants us. He knows that we will, and he's respecting his audience. with all of those things because he knows that we're going to be, he expects us to be engaged and it'll pay off. And that involves us more in the story. We're singing praises here.
This is who he is. The Arrival, yes. 2049. This shit requires you to fucking think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Movies require you to think.
They're not necessarily scenes, but I would like to comment, since we're talking about like technology, like the ornithopter, there's little subtle things that you don't explain that I really liked. I like the scene where they transition, where the Duke does a seal. You see the Spacing Guild guys, and that's the only scene they're in. And they don't say anything. They don't do anything. They're just dudes in bubbles with effing spice. Breathing spice.
Yeah.
And they don't explain that in the movie. They don't hint at it whatsoever. You don't see them. They don't speak. And I'm really curious about how much we're going to get of them in part two. Because, like, they're a fascinating thing that, like, we don't get much of in the book, really. In the first book, at least. And
they're going to have to, because the Spacing Guild are such huge power players.
Yeah. Huge, just as much as the Bene Gesserits are,
Well, the three legs of civilization are the three partners in the Spacing Guild, isn't it? It's the Emperor's House, the Bene Gesserit, and the Spacing Guild. They're like equal partners or something, aren't they?
Mm.
When it comes to the Chome Corporation or whatever the hell.
Chome is the Great Houses.
I thought that was the Lansrad.
The Lansrad, right?
Yeah. Chome is the commercial side of it.
Yeah.
Lansrad is like the legislature.
I got you.
Oh.
Okay. It's like the House of Lords.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Spacing Guild will have a pivotal role in part two because Paul ultimately understands it's all about power and leverage, and you don't have to say all of that in part one.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to know, and that voiceover sort of speaks to it. They allow interstellar space travel.
And there's this scene, and I don't know if you guys saw this time, when the Bene Gesserit sister comes in her ship by herself.
Yeah.
You see the tunnel ship, and you're in space over Caladan, and you see that there's a planet through the tunnel, but it's not on the outside. So they're creating a
subtle change from the book. Where
it's not a ship, it's a gate, they're bending space through this tunnel,
everybody goes inside this massive ship, and then they fold, like, the what thing how they travel is a there's a series of gateways, and the Spacing Guild like enable those to function.
Yes. Yes.
Right? So it's not, you know, they board the Highliner, all the Atreides frigates board the Highliner, and then the Highliner moves in the book.
Uh-huh.
Are they changing the nature of this, the realization of space travel in the movie, that the Spacing Guild maintains the highway?
Yeah. It's
not necessarily that they operate all the ships, but they maintain all the highways.
It'll be interesting to see if they flesh that out in part two, because
it's just one shot. It's not explained.
The technology is invented for the ships, but the only way that it works is as if you can predict the pathway.
Yes, mm-hmm. through time and space.
And design the pathway so that you don't fly through, you don't fold into a sun.
Yeah,
I mean, that's what's going on there. And that's why it has that quality. Spice has that quality in the Spacing Guild. People who are in the Spacing Guild, because they can see limited, in short term, they can see the future. That's how that works.
And there's lots of hints of that, of like Paul's dreaming, visions of Chani, and visions of his death. He sees his death a few times. Like, I noticed that second and third watching, he sees his death a few times. He sees the guy he has to kill, At the end of like, I will show you the way. I'm going to teach you the way of the and then he kills that guy.
Amazing. What an amazing thing. Yeah.
He teaches. He has to kill that guy. So it's sort of like
the scene where Paul is dreaming about, and this character name escapes me. I know it starts with a J. When he's dreaming about him and he's seeing him, and the actor plays that moment with such warmth and openness to Paul, saying, he's like, I will show you the way. I'm your teacher. You know, it's done with a lot of love and openness. And then when the reality of the moment comes up, he challenges Paul to a duel to the death.
He challenges Jessica to a duel to the death. Yeah,
exactly. And it becomes Paul's transformation moment that he has to kill someone in a formal Fremen combat.
Here's something that like is really awesome that gives me chills thinking about it is like they subtly hint like that Gurney Halleck is a badass and who's Jason Momoa again?
Duncan Idaho
are badasses. They're like, these two are badasses, and they've been training Paul his whole life. And he hasn't had to kill anybody before, but he can fight a grown ass adult and win easily.
From Jessica too. Jessica's been training him in a weirding way his whole life.
Yeah,
the Bene Gesserit form of fighting as well that men aren't taught. Right. She taught him that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's all a combination of all of those influences that has turned him to make him ready for that moment. Jessica, Duncan, Gurney, his father, every moment of his life has led him to this combat.
That's the beginning of his next life. And then it's sort of like it's never really it's done so like shittily in the David Lynch version, and you sort of just like you can see that like he's just a boy, like he hasn't had to do anything, he hasn't had to fight anybody, he hasn't fought anybody the whole movie, and then suddenly it's like this grown-ass man who knows how to fight, who's a good fighter, he won't make you suffer, he whoops his ass easily.
And that that moment crystallizes why Chalamet is perfectly cast.
Yes!
Because you see him without a shirt on earlier.
Yeah.
He's a scrawny kid.
He is.
Oh, yeah. But then, like, what he becomes is just so epic. And I love this, like, just slow burn of, like, I'm going to tell you why he's a badass. I'm going to tell you why he's a badass. And then it's like, you think he's going to die, but no. The audience has no idea what they're seeing, and it's incredible filmmaking. It's just, I mean, obviously we love this movie. They've already announced part two.
Yeah.
Denis Villeneuve went on quoting saying he wants to make Dune Messiah. He saw this as a trilogy. So we might get two more movies.
That Paul's story ends in Dune Messiah. If he wants to tell Paul's story, he'll make Dune Messiah.
And I haven't read Dune Messiah. Is it a good story, Christopher?
It's fantastic.
Okay, I have to read. If they greenlight Dune Messiah, I'm going to read it for sure.
I'm saying it right now. I guarantee they're greenlighting it.
Yeah, I mean it's sort of like it's like I don't know numbers, Andrew. Did you see how much money this? It made a bunch of money, right? Like it did well, even though it was on Warner Brothers.
74 million first weekend. 70 some million.
I was trying to come up with a good like trivia question, but none. Honestly, it feels like it kind of cheapens it a little bit.
But,
so the domestic grosses, it's made $84 million in the U.S. It's made 250 internationally.
Yeah.
The total monies right now are $331 million.
So it's, I mean, I feel like numbers can't be compared to what they were before COVID because like people aren't going to theaters.
COVID numbers.
These are giant COVID numbers for sure. Yeah. Like comparatively to what we've had.
This movie, I mean, and it not being an MCU movie, it not being a Marvel movie, putting up numbers like this, people go to the movies to see Marvel. They will. I mean, Black Widow proved that. Shang-Chi proved that. I mean, I think there's going to be articles written, if there hasn't already, about how Shang-Chi basically saved movie theaters when it came out and did the numbers that it did.
I mean,
we're almost in a post-movie theater world.
We're talking Dune, but did either of you guys see Eternals? I haven't seen it yet.
I went.
Sean's going to be in town this week. I'm going to see Eternals with him.
I'm gonna force Hannah to go see it with me during this week, I think. What an evening movie time.
Ashton and I went and saw it. Yeah.
Well, just save your save what yeah, you thought sure. For.
I'm gonna see it this weekend, so
we'll talk about it next week.
Yeah, so, we'll talk about it next week.
Okay.
Did everybody answer what their favorite scene was?
Yeah, I mean, Andrew, you didn't really. You said you liked
The moment with Duncan Idaho, like those. Kind
oh,
of
that's
from,
right.
The I mean, Momoa is so much fun to watch.
Well, little details like that, I really love. And then like the subtle explanation of things without explanation, because I think that like they tell you just enough. And I'm trying to think of like what is. My favorite scene always in the book was, and it's amazing in this movie, obviously, is when they fly up on the spice collector and they're like inspecting, and then the thing breaks and they have to get the people, and you see the worm for the first time. The worm's coming and Paul breathes in the fresh spice and he starts to see the future. Crazy shit happens. And they get him on the ship just in time, and then just like that thing comes up out of the ground, and Paul is hanging off the end of
the shot. That's my favorite shot.
And you just see the thing fall into the mouth of this
worm, the worm's mouth, and that shot through Paul as he's watching. He's on the ramp, and the mouth closes on the crawler. I mean, that's an incredible shot.
Well, and what's terrifying is that, like, this is just a subtle moment, too, is, like, when they're running back to the ornithopter, they fall over as the worm gets closer, and they start to sink. Like, think about that. You're trying to run.
It becomes like water.
Yeah, you're running from this giant thing underneath you, and of course it would, like, make the sand over it soft, and it's like this little detail, like, shit. Like, we're going into the, like, it's sucking us down. And they even, like, suck those guys, the Sardaukar and Dr. Leah Kynes later. So it's sort of like, it doesn't need to just come out of the ground and eat you and smush you. It could just, like, cause you to get swallowed up into the sand, and then you're dead. Like,
I love the little, so I keep coming back to these little subtle touches that Denis or whomever brings to it, but what about the moments when the Sardaukar are like dropping into frame, like they're like paratroopers or like shock troopers? They clearly have some kind of anti-gravity technology that lets them kind of just descend from above. Like they're like the perfect realization of shock / paratroopers, you know, like they're the 101st Airborne, and they just like drop on you and you're fucking dead, because they're the, you know, at the time, they're the most feared warriors in the galaxy because they're so, you know, committed and everything. It's those kind of little moments where it's like, yeah, they're anti-gravity shock troopers.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Also, I really love, technology-wise, I love the representation of the lasers. I think the lasers are really, because, like, you know, I've watched Star Trek my whole life. I've seen Star Wars. And this idea of, like, you shoot these, like, laser blasts, you know, and as in a fighter are like pew 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 pew, you know, but these are like you have a laser, like a beam that just cuts through everything.
Yeah.
And then when he's trying to fly away from that ship, and it's just cutting through the city trying to get it.
It's such an incredible shot when he's trying to ascend out of that hangar, and the laser is chasing him as he's flying.
Just trying to cut and just cutting shit up.
It's bananas.
So stuff like that.
I got to watch the movie again. I got to watch it again.
Dude, the third time. Yeah. I put it on at home with like my really good, I have these really good Bluetooth Sony Bluetooth headphones.
Ashton's out of town this weekend. I think I'm going to watch it this weekend.
I mean, if you've listened to us long enough to talk about this and you haven't seen it, go watch this movie with headphones, or if you're watching it at home, because I love good audio, and it's like, obviously go to the theater. Go see it in a theater in IMAX, but like watching it at home, the sound quality is so good. The music is incredible. All the sound of the voice is incredible. All the sound effects are amazing. And it's just a good, well-made movie. It's just science fiction at its finest.
Every level of this movie is well-made.
Science fiction at its finest. That's all it is.
Here's there's one. I have one disappointment. With part one.
Sure.
I understand why he cut it, because then the first movie is 3 hours and 15 minutes long. But cutting the scene where they have the dinner after they come to Arrakis, and, you know, it's like that state dinner where they have all the politicians and the water seller. That whole, remember that scene from the book where it's all this intrigue around the table and there's all this politics? In conversations about, they're sort of figuring out, and Jessica's observing, and it's by design that they have this, and they bring everybody to the keep, and they have this dinner to really suss out, get the lay of the land, and that is a hugely important political scene for especially Jessica to learn, but I understand Villeneuve cutting it because the later sort of what happens later really eliminates all of the sort of breaks the connection between all of those players around that table and then what happens later. But I really like that scene from the book. And so that was my one disappointment, was cutting that scene from the book. I just love the touch. They didn't do enough, in my view, of Villeneuve didn't do enough to really hammer home the precious nature of water on Arrakis. I mean, there was a subtle sort of little thing, but that scene where they talk about that room that is a room in the keep that is a, you know, lots of greenery.
Yeah.
And how Jessica decides to sort of continue the practice or renew the practice of giving squeezings of water from the towels and stuff to the people in Arrakeen is reinforced. There's multiple scenes like that that reinforce how water is, people think spice is the most precious thing on Arrakis, but it's actually water. And
water's
that plays
the resource, spice is the commodity.
Right, and I hope that in part two, because it's going to have to, and maybe there'll be flashbacks in part two about exactly that scarcity of water and why it's so important for the overall sort of plan, the Fremen's plan and Kynes's plan. So it's an interesting
We'll see a lot of like Fremen stuff, and hopefully they touch on that a lot. And I mean, they mention it a decent amount, and they talk about like, you're only worth it to us for the water in your body. Like, you don't run and waste your water. Like, that's all they care about is
the problem is they didn't do, I don't think Villeneuve did a good enough job for like teeing that up. We talked about how good he did teeing up other stuff.
Sure.
He didn't for that to really land, that moment to really land about we got to save the water from the body. Mm-hmm. It should have done more at the front end to speak about how supremely scarce water is.
Yeah. That's fair.
Definitely.
All right. Well, I feel like we've talked enough about Dune.
I could talk about the concept for
10 hours.
I'm sure we're gonna watch it again.
This is one of those. Obviously this movie will stand the test of time. It's clearly too soon to say whether or not this is an all-time great science fiction movie. But for me, I am happy that this movie has now, like, the big important moments that stick in your head from the book are not images from David Lynch's version.
Right.
I now have Denis Villeneuve's breathtaking imagery in my head for these moments rather than David Lynch's admittedly ugly.
Yeah.
Moments. Yeah. That movie has ugliness on screen in a lot of ways, and now we have the just
It's just silly.
Denis Vision.
And we didn't even talk about like Baron Harkonnen, but like making him terrifying is pretty good too. He was so terrifying. And then the other one, he was just Jerry like,
shit. I even talked about the Harkonnen depictions, and I thought they were just right. You know, the evil.
The least human humans.
They don't even introduce Fade at all. Do you think we'll see the Emperor?
Fade is like Paul's mirror image. It's how he's brought up. So he'll
Fade
have to be
and the Emperor and Irulan all will be in part two.
Yeah, I mean we'll see a lot more characters.
Years, they're gonna Irulan. Start. I saw something on the internet today that they're gonna shoot the movie next summer.
Wow.
Yeah, they're gonna start production like July or something.
It's gonna be cool, man. So cool. Yeah.
Can't wait.
Very exciting. So awesome. Did you have trivia for us, Andrew?
I actually don't. I was trying to find something good to ask about this movie, but we've talked about it so much that there just wasn't. I didn't want to do a box office question. This movie's like too important for that, you know? It's all too right. important. We've Fine. Been talking about this movie since podcast one, and here we are, podcast 167.
Mm-hmm.
We have seen part one of the movie that we've always wanted.
Yep.
And part two is now 2 years away.
It's exactly what we wanted. And I'm really happy that we're all like so satisfied with it. It's just that it's very like satisfying, you know, to finally get this thing that we all, yeah.
To have these, have our, one of our favorite filmmakers make it and pull it off.
Yeah.
You know, 9.9 out of 10 is just, it's great.
Very satisfying.
It is a very satisfying moment for me.
If you'd like to help Andrew with his trivia, you should email him at kingofthenorth52@gmail.com.
He needs help.
Yeah, he needs help, obviously. You should email the podcast, brothersgeekpodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on brothersgeek.com and brothers_geek at Twitter. Brothers Geek Do Stuff on Instagram. That's right.
There's a picture of us going to this movie with our dad.
That's right.
On Brothers Geek Do Stuff. It's a very charming photo.
We got to talk about that a little bit. We kind of glossed over that, but didn't mention it at all. But part of the satisfying nature of going to see this was the fact that dad went with us.
Yeah, and we saw it in IMAX, and Dad went with us.
We saw it in IMAX, and Dad went, and, you know, Dad is the OG of the family, right? In 100%. Science fiction, and he got me into it, and he sort of produced all of us. And so I was extremely happy that all of us could go together. We, of course, invited Daniel, and he was out of town.
Yeah,
but I was very, very happy that Dad could go with us. So
yeah, that was nice. It was really nice for us to be able to go with
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and go
save
see Dune.
The world. Get the vaccine.
Fear is the mind killer.